Hi guys.
Hi.
It's really nice to be here. So I just wanted to make, kind of like get us started, have some brief comments. Before coming here, I was reading up on Cosmo, Cosmopolitan, for those of you who don't know, the fashion mag. And they were like, they had an article 2 days ago advertising a strike for February 17th. And I thought between Cosmopolitan and Teen Vogue, we have a chance, and perhaps better than most of us in this room. But I think besides kind of like poking fun of that, I think we're living in this really interesting moment where if we look at, I mean, as the speakers have talked about, if we look at it nationally and internationally, we are seeing a consolidation of the far right. And we're also seeing that amidst the crisis of liberalism, neoliberalism, but also, most importantly, the crisis of social reproduction. And this is, it's coming out in like these really important ways, like with the Trump misogyny, transphobia, quote-unquote women's issues were like an important part of the presidency as well. And kind of what I want to push us to think about is, to what extent is some of the quote-unquote women's issues and gender issues being framed around electoral politics and the limits of that, and how useful left can be to push that further, right? Like, you know, will it fall into a reimagination of the DNC? Like, are we going to see Cory Booker, because, you know, he was a favorite in the Women's March, right? Like, hopefully not. But some of the points that I want to kind of bring up is that part of what I am interested in as well is that liberal feminism, we know, is not a solution, right? Like, the Hillbot pantsuit nation cannot solve the crisis that we're facing. Most similarly, because around work, right, especially we saw under Obama the creation of new quote-unquote jobs, mostly low-service sector, mostly done by women of color, right, and low-income folks. We're also seeing now the right, the legislation against right-to-work legislation, right, which will actually gut public service sector unions, the majority of which are women. Right, so we're kind of like in this interesting moment. We had a Women's March, very briefly, very liberal, mostly called by the Democratic Party, social justice warriors, nonprofits, celebrities, but Madonna did say she wants to burn down the White House. So that was like an awesome highlight of that. But it did draw out 2.9 million people, 600 sister marches nationally and internationally. So a lot of folks are in the streets for the first time. Teenagers yelling, "My body, my choice," which is awesome. So I think we're in this interesting moment, but of course that has some implications and limitations, right? It draws out new folks. Also, it draws out folks that perhaps have been attending already BLM, No DF, whatever, marches and protests, whose politics are being shaped by this moment, right? And that's something to note. Liberal kind of elements still dominate, I think. The speakers were urged to call on their electoral politicians, right? Call your senator. The fact that there was no police confrontation was seen as a big thing, and we don't know how much of that was due to the day before, or the fact that, like, you know, we're women. We don't, like, fight back. We, like, give cops pink pussy hats or something. And sort of that's also, like, interesting. And even the more progressive organizers, like Linda Sarsour, who is, like, totally, like, kind of like taken by the outright McGinnis and, you know, blamed for like making this an Islamic thing, like Women's March being an Islamic attempt to take over the world or something. Even she has really like liberal elements. Like, she just wants everyone to like participate in mass Democratic Party and for all of us to like vote for the DNC in 2020.
She said Israel has a right to exist.
Yeah, so kind of contradictions. And then, so lastly, then the resistance to Trump boils down in like a set of policies, like all of the things that are really important, right? Like reproductive rights, misogyny, transphobia, but of course could easily play into the hands of a Democratic Party, right? And this is the question, right? Like, will the Democratic Party be able to kind of take that in? Are there limits to this lean-in feminism and pantsuit nation, which of course they are? And then lastly, the second thing I wanted to point out was, I thought the most promising part of the protests were actually the airport and the anti-Milo protests, because I think they spoke to a couple of things. Number one, which is direct action, which is very different from civil disobedience, in that it does not seek to legitimize the state, right? It seeks to kind of challenge the boundaries of society. It brings people together in really important ways, and it makes people feel powerful. And it's actually playing on these contradictions, right? So somebody will hold a glitter sign, which, by the way, I love, nothing against glitter, like, love trumps hate, but like you'll block a TSA checkpoint or like are like I'm not gonna leave this airport until like all of the detainees go home. And I think those are like the useful contradictions that are really important to highlight in this moment. And then also like everybody's all about punching Nazis now. but smashing windows still not okay. So you know, we still have some ways to push, you know. But I think it's these marches that have the potential to go beyond nonprofits, even though they're being called by liberals, because they could be more militant, right? And they could, the nonprofits and the liberals can now wield sort of the power that could emerge out of this. And then the last thing I'll just say is that this also has the potential to start connecting struggles. And for me, this is really the where I see the left being useful in some type of way, and which I don't even know anymore, but sometimes. But I think, right, it connects struggles, and it's through these direct actions, through people like making the connections between like transphobia, racism, misogyny, and the fact that like our livelihoods are really hard. Like it's so hard to reproduce your day on your existence on a daily level, right? So hopefully, like kind of these direct actions for me like are important in that. So yeah, that was one question I had, is just that, like, what kind of actions can we see that will make that will gel these connections and hopefully provide some role for the left? Like, is there a role for the left other than just going to these protests and observing everything that's happening? That's it.
I'm Wilson Sherwin. I think that Jana has brought up a lot of really good, important points about the failures of liberal feminism, right? That if we're looking at this particular moment, we see the failure of Hillary Clinton to win as a real kind of failure of the power of liberal feminism. And also the fact that Trump won is this really intense example of the strength of misogyny. And so I think that this is a moment that we can sort of perhaps in this deep crisis, because I think that it's important to remember, right, crises are also opportunities. And that this is an opportunity to to rethink what is women's liberation, right? And I think that this is a fairly sort of simple, basic foundational idea, but I'd like to just take a second and remind ourselves, right, what is really at the heart of this. And I think that maybe we could say most generally, right, that the absolutely necessary, although insufficient, condition for women's liberation is bodily autonomy, right? And I think that we can break this down into sort of three different areas that are encompassed by this overarching concept of bodily autonomy, right? And I think that they are, I sort of pitch that idea on a fairly abstract level because I think that it allows us to conceive of all of these different aspects under one umbrella. And the first is really the importance of solidarity with our trans sisters, right? The importance of avoiding a kind of biological essentialism and saying that bodily autonomy is deeply, deeply, deeply important to a way that we conceive of the importance of trans politics as a woman's issue, right? And I'm unfortunately sort of for time's sake not going to talk about that so much. But the other two aspects that I am going to talk about a little bit more is freedom from sexual violence, right? And the third is the issue of reproductive rights, right? And I think that these are really, truly, like to say again, right, the absolutely necessary, although insufficient, conditions for women's liberation. And unfortunately, I think that this is a moment where we can really have a little bit of self-critique of the left and especially the far left's relationship to these issues, right? I think in a lot of ways we have seen in the past decades that the left has ceded these issues to liberal feminism, right? We have really failed to be out there front and center talking about the issues of abortion, the issues of sexual violence, right? We have ceded these to liberal feminism, and I think that that is a massive flaw of the contemporary left project, right? And in this moment, we really have to step up and refocus on those issues, right? And I think maybe to step back for a second, I think that it is important that we could ask ourselves if there is a reason why these issues have become the purview of liberal feminism, right? Is there something fundamental about them that is deeply liberal? Secondly, I think we can ask ourselves, right, is there something about them that maybe tactically really lends themselves to liberal tactics, right? Something about the issues of reproductive justice or sexual violence that maybe just tactically it makes more sense for liberals to take care of these issues and for us to focus on other things. And I think that, I'd like to discuss this all together, but I think that fairly clearly that the response is no, right? There is not something fundamentally liberal about demanding bodily autonomy in the form of reproductive rights and freedom from sexual violence, right? That these are fundamentally consonant with a radical politics, right? And must be. And so I think that if the answer is no to those questions, right, that, you know, are these inherently liberal concerns, I think that what we have to do then is ask ourselves, why has the left, why has the far left, why have we ceded these to liberals, right? What is the reason that we have stopped putting these concerns front and center in our demands, in our striving for human emancipation? Right, and I think that especially in a room full of so many men, that it is really important to ask ourselves these questions and to think about how we can recommit ourselves to these really deeply, fundamentally important issues that are. The reproductive rights are coming under extraordinary threat. They always are under threat, right? But they are under extreme threat in a way. That it should be terrifying for all of us, and the kind of normalization of sexual violence in the mainstream media is just flabbergasting. Right, this is a moment in which it can absolutely no longer be liberal white feminists who are concerned with these issues. It is time for men to step up and also demonstrate massive solidarity around these concerns, right? And I think that as we're talking about the sort of, the excitement over the kinds of black bloc tactics gaining a kind of legitimacy, that issues like, defending women seeking abortions or defending abortion doctors who face constant violent physical threat, right? That these are kinds of things that we could imagine concerns that far left tactics could really use, right? That we could really could be helpful in these situations. And I think just one final point, and then I would like to open it up for discussion, is that these are also really important issues through which people become radicalized, right? Through which people become politicized. These are deeply personal ways in which we see the kinds of contradictions of capitalism and inequality and injustice, right? And if we cede these to liberals, we really lose the opportunity to mobilize folks from their kind of initial questioning or initial politicization that they're happening through their encounters with a really fucked up medical system or court system, right? That this is a really important opportunity for the left to say, these are our issues also. This doesn't stop at liberal feminism, right?
Michelle.
Excellent presentations. Wilson mentioned solidarity with trans sisters, and I don't have a question, but I wanted to offer to talk for a few minutes about some of the odd conjuncture in this moment around trans women. Would that be?
Yeah.
So the last few years, things have been developing around trans politics in the United States in some really odd ways. Like, since the winning of gay marriage, a whole host of wealthy gay donors have really abandoned the movement, and it's become increasingly clear that there's this, this has been true for a long time, but that the intensity of labor market discrimination against trans people means that there's this very large group of extremely poor trans women of color surviving in sex work and other things, and that the LGBT movement, by and large, has been willing to abandon them. And then at the same time, there's been a kind of breakthrough in visibility of trans issues nationally that I'm sure we've all seen. And the right has really responded to this. They're like, we've lost on the gay front, we lost on gay marriage, but we can go after these trans freaks. And we saw, you know, 35 states moving forward on bills banning trans people from using bathrooms and other things, like a very aggressive trans attack. And then on the alt-right, trans issues have played a bizarre centrality of their thinking. So Milo Yiannopoulos outed a trans woman and made fun of her in one of his talks, who was a student at the campus he was speaking on. Doug McInnes wrote Transphobia is Perfectly Natural as one of his breakthrough essays. Richard Spencer joked that he should title his campus tour talk this year Revenge of the Cis as in non-trans. And a lot of trans leftists have been trying to figure out why this is, and one of the thinking is that in their model of the world, there is a place for black people and women and brown people, that they all, if they could be subordinated and restricted, they'd be okay, but there is no place for trans women. They're this pure embodiment of like countercultural horror of our society, and that their eradication is the only, or their complete exclusion is the only way they can make sense of it. And they find it a very useful kind of recruiting ground for people with very far-right cultural sympathies and hostility around gender issues. And the response to this has been mixed. A chunk of the liberal left has suggested that perhaps the defense of trans women is why Hillary Clinton lost the presidential election and why local Democrats lost in all these states, and that we need to abandon these trivial minoritarian issues to like focus on a social democratic agenda. Mm-hmm. And then there's a much, because trans women are often quite economically marginalized, there is a significant subculture of insurrectionist trans people in any given major city. But then a kind of broader left milieu has really not known how to move past a sort of surface trans inclusion to thinking about trans issues in an integrated left revolutionary way, and has not done much to kind of orient or pay attention to the trans leftists trying to sort that out.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Mary.
Go ahead, Mary.
Oh, okay. I have a question. If you define women's liberation as protection from sexual violence and as defense of reproductive rights, then haven't you, by using those components, you have ceded the ground to the liberal state, and you've ceded the ground to lawsuits and calling the cops, right? So there would need to be something beyond these things to give a meaning to women's liberation. And I think that the person who was just speaking might have like drawn the proper response from this, which is that, you know, the trans people, poor trans people, would need to be included somehow in some program for women's liberation, which would mean defense of class interests, which would mean, you know, something stronger. And I would just also challenge y'all, I mean, can you respond to, like, the fact that the gay movement went from Stonewall, you know, fighting with the cops in the street, to gay marriage, and wanting, you know, 401k benefits and distributions and stuff like that. The same thing with the civil rights movement. You know, they went from, you know, marching in the street to doing lawsuits and court cases and stuff like this. I mean, it seems similar to me, formally.
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, sure.
I just want to be clear that I think especially one of the reasons why it's important for the left, the far left, the revolutionary left, whatever we want to call it, to engage in questions around sexual violence, for example, is precisely that to make clear that the only response is not just calling the cops, right? That this needs to be a broader political transformation, and that you know, our critique of the carceral state is also an important component to talking about sexual violence, right? That we do not pit the well-being and the safety of women against the well-being and the safety of men who are, especially men of color, who are incarcerated at higher rates for, you know, accusations and often trumped up charges of rape, etc. So to say that sexual freedom from sexual violence is exclusively a liberal and, you know, only involves the cops, I think is very, very short-sighted.
Sorry, I just want to add one thing. Can I just add something? I think part of, like, also in thinking about, like, what women's liberation is and, with, like, all the comments that have been made so far, which were really good, thank you. It's also, I think, part of it, too, is, like, look, like, for so long, like, part of, like, liberal feminism and, like, this, you also see this in, like, gay rights, whatever. It's, like, yeah, like, it's great if you have, like, a really good job and, like, benefits that you could pass on to marriage. But if, like, you're broke, like, a lot of people, like, you ain't passing down shit, you know? And I think, like, part of the work thing is this, too. It's, like, work for liberal feminism was, like, the linchpin of, like, this is what we want. We want to be included in the sphere of production, the Betty Friedans and the Sheryl Sandbergs. But it's, like, that is not liberating at all, like, right? And so you see this also in terms of, like, who has access to, like, these rights or benefits granted through marriage or, like, even through the legal system, right? They're not available for most people that are doing, like, really shitty low service sector jobs, you know? Or who experience violence also because, you know, now you're in, you know, you're sometimes in a household, you're making do with a lot of stuff. Now you have to listen to whoever you're living with, and that burden falls on you, you know, and you're more open to, I think, also, like, other forms of violence, right? So it's kind of, like, also connected to the relationship to work, and I think for me personally, like, women's liberation is, like, less work, like, no work, fuck work, you know, and I think, like, that's part of it, too, and it's not being talked about, and I think that's something that we have not considered to liberal feminism, because Sheryl Sandberg wants to tell us that if we all just lean in and be great, like, it's not a possibility, it's not, you know, and I think that's what, I don't know if that makes sense, but.
Do you have a question?
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to also make some remarks. Hi, I'm Naomi Russell. I think I'm old, I'm 74, so I remember the second wave of the women's liberation because it had a big effect on me. And one of the things that happened at the beginning of that was that there were left women who were involved in that and who broke off from dealing with the left men, so to speak, because the left men were used to being in charge, used to being able to talk to each other, used to having the women take care of the kind of dirty work, which is what women have done over millennia. So I think we have similar problems right now, today. I mean, any of you men who came to this meeting or sitting in this meeting, did you notice that there were relatively few women in the group? Did you have a sense like there's something wrong with this? Like maybe I'm not comfortable with this? Did you have a sense that the men calling on each other and talking to each other might be a problem of some sort? Like, the problem that I think we have is that our consciousness is so deeply embedded with male supremacy as well as white supremacy. It starts when you're born, really. So you get used to that kind of an atmosphere. And the left is certainly what you're calling the far left, the revolutionary left, has the same problems that the rest of the society has in terms of understanding what the relationship of men and women can be, or the relationship of people who are not men or women can be. You know, that those are things that need to be talked about, but there's an emotional aspect to this, and there's a cognitive aspect to this that we have to be very aware of and try to change if we really want to have a liberation movement.
Can you say a name, please?
Yeah. Antonia. Yeah, so just to add on, and I think both of you are talking about this, but how important it is that, you know, moving past this liberal feminism that we've been seeing that has existed that's been so white, that's really been calling forth how what feminism looks like and not taking into account what, like, now more and more we're hearing intersectionality and all these movements and issues are coming together that are, that feminism, we're looking at it more in an intersectional way and calling to the forefront the women that haven't been part of the feminist movement,
mm-hmm.
And like women of color, trans women, just like what, how do we create a new wave of feminism that looks and is calling in things in a different manner?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think a large part of the problem is that the trade union leadership, and I use that in very loose terms, has essentially ceded all of this to the middle class and to the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than, even at the Washington demonstration, where there was no visible contingents of women workers whatsoever, and the one trade union leader, Randy Weingarten, really talked about how do we get to the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
It was really nothing about the strength. I mean, women are at least 50%, if not more, of the workforce, and yet none of that gets reflected in any of the discussions of any of the union meetings that I've ever been in, and I've been in many union meetings in my life. I'm in a number of different unions. And so the liberals appropriate all that stuff
mm-hmm.
to themselves, and the trade union leaders are more than happy to allow them to do it. And as the working class, largely women, will begin to assert ourselves in not only our demands as workers, but also as women workers, then those issues will be put more on the table, and that people will not be able to, you know, identify them as those liberals or, you know, something outside of what trade union women or working class women absolutely have to do in order to not only sustain us, but to sustain the entire society. I mean, mostly the family falls on the backs of women. Women are generally very often alone, raising kids on their own. So social wage has to be, you know, part of the language for women workers, not just for men workers anymore. And that we have to begin to step up and start talking about how the working class can not only challenge the Democratic Party, but also how it's only the working class that's going to be able to win these kinds of demands, and it's not going to be able to win them under capitalism anyway. But we have to start, you know, I have a problem with the word intersectionality, but we have to start talking about ourselves as being working class, communists, anti-democratic party, you know, people who want to really overthrow the society, because the first people in any war who are going to get attacked are women. And so you can see that in the Congo, you can see that in large in areas where their war is physically raging, but there's a war against women in the United States. And we are the easiest people to go at because it's part of our culture. And I think that's, you know, unfortunately part of the left, and the left has to begin to, they're not going to overthrow it overnight, but they have to begin to examine it and use the language not of, you know, just sexism, but how do we really liberate the entire society? And that's going to be the working class who's going to step up and really say what we need is a different kind of society altogether, one that's not based on sexism, racism, and the whole thing.
Would you guys like to respond to anything that's been said in this last round?
I just want to say, like, I think the only thing I would try to, like, intervene on is, like, look, for me, it's like, I don't care what people terms people use. Like, I think if people use intersectionality, but they're willing to, like, block a TSA checkpoint and, like, punch a Nazi, I'm like, get it, girl. Like, you know, and I think, like, that's the moment we're in, perhaps, maybe, and maybe those contradictions will come out. But I think it's very easy for, like, the Democratic Party to bring in women of color in. I mean, we saw this with the march, right? Like, Linda Sarsour, Carmen Perez, all these women, you know, and they're, oh, look, this is intersectionality, right? And that's different from, like, on-the-ground stuff where, like, people are gelling, like, struggles are kind of gelling together. You had the anti-Milos. Man, the most beautiful image was, like, these pink sequined flags that were being, like, shot out of.
Like, your own candles.
Like, this is awesome, you know? And, like, I think, like, for me, that's, like, more important, I think.
I
yeah.
Do you have anything to add, Wilson? Okay, so we have...
Dan's had his hand up for a
while. Oh, Dan, you want...
I have a question for Wilson, actually. you said that Trump's victory was showed the strength of misogyny, but Trump actually lost by 3 million votes. So does that show the weakness of misogyny?
Do you have... Do you want to take a crack at that?
It's very important to sort of try to gauge what the strength of these forces are. And Wilson cited Trump's victory as an example of the strength of these forces.
He got
But he got 3 million votes
less. He got 49% of the vote as a rate.
No, he didn't. He got 45% of the vote.
I think it's 45%.
Okay. Can we not go over numbers?
He's our president. Like, he's our president. He's all of our president. Also the all of our president.
Okay, all right, guys. I'm going to have to bring law and order to this if Wilson doesn't want to respond to that,
I mean, he's our president,
yeah,
so the success of misogyny, it seems like
right. That's the important, I think the numbers don't matter so much. I think what matters is like the growing strength of like this alt-right movement, which is very fucking scary, like, you know what I mean? And like they're very open about how much they hate women and their misogyny, and the fact that like all of a sudden we're seeing like these people feeling empowered to this degree is perhaps what we should be pointing to, you know? Like, I don't know if that's what you meant, but yeah, I don't think the 45%, 49%, but who gives a shit? The point is that we're in a new moment now where we're seeing this type of ideology just like spreading and people being more vocal.
If I could toss in very quickly, I think Matt hinted at this a little bit, but the degree of misogyny that was allowed to pervade the Trump coalition and the alt-right was actually shocking to the old-school Nazis. Like, if you read like what some of these guys think about a website like the Daily Stormer, which is explicitly misogynistic in its approach to all women, they say, "How dare this young man speak that way about white women?" Now, the rest of y'all, I mean, you're on your own. But no, it's actually shocking to the Nazis how misogynistic this movement has become. And I think that Matt was very correct to point that out. So I think, Shimon, you had something?
Yeah, I wanted to ask Wilson, you brought up sexual violence, and that's an issue that's come up in some of the political work. I'm involved with Comrades and Friends in Queens, and we've thought a lot about how to do street patrols on Roosevelt Avenue, which has a lot of sex workers and a lot of bars on that street. And of course, instantly you talk about street patrols, you end up talking about, well, who are we going to be getting in violent, potentially conflict with? And of course, everyone in the group raised, you know, it's going to be exactly the point you said. It's going to be a lot of men of color, specifically Latino men, generally speaking. And so I guess the question is, I mean, that's the setup or the story. The question is, is that the correct entry point in dealing with sexual violence? It seems like we're reaching a certain contradiction that's very difficult to cross over or have a resolution other than getting in potentially very dangerous fights with people. How do we begin? Our group strategy is we want to fight, we want to fight Trump, but we also want to deal with the internal shit in the class, and we ended up saying, let's deal with this, because for a lot of reasons. And we're not sure, though, I don't want to speak for the group, I'm not sure if this is the best place to intervene in that way because of the problems we're facing. Yeah, I don't know if you have any suggestion or advice, etc.
You guys want to respond to that?
No. I mean, I don't have the answer. I think that the point is that we need to be having these conversations on the left, and that we need to be taking this really seriously and talking about it now, and having men think about how they can intervene in sexual violence and how they can, you know, assess and address internalized misogyny. And I think that, you know, like, and weighing the sort of pros and cons in the same way that we have been over the efficacy of the Black block tactics in terms of countering the alt-right, right? I mean, we have been debating this, and I think we need to be sort of similarly mulling over together how we can intervene and how we can undermine sexual violence in a lot of different ways, and whether it's doing it on the street or, what kind of accountability, alternative accountability things we can set up so that it's not just going to the cops, right? I mean, I think that those are all things we need to just be talking and thinking about more together.
So we have Louise, John, is this a point of process? Or?
No.
Oh, okay, so Louise?
Louise, I think just taking some of the questions that were asked earlier in terms of how to deal with liberal feminism, and I just want to speak a little bit about our experience coming from Arizona.
Yeah.
We've been working mostly with undocumented folks there for many years, and over the last couple of years, the struggle really got connected to mostly people in hotels, because we live in an area that has a lot of hotels. People are coming through to go to the Grand Canyon stop in our town that we live in. And most of the people that work in those hotels are undocumented folks, and particularly women, of course, who are cleaning those rooms. So the level of wage theft, the level of getting fired, not getting paid for the last 2 weeks, the inability to have days off in order to, because their kids are sick, they sometimes have to bring the sick kids to work and actually put them to work. I mean, it's just endless, and if you're involved in that, you probably have heard all these things before. Our group has been mostly made up of women from these hotels that have been dedicated to this work for a while and have been connected to us. I think that answers some of that, what it looks like. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that from that experience, we almost have zero of these kinds of discussions, mm-hmm. even speaking about gender in those particular ways. It doesn't mean that there's no patriarchy there or that we're somehow liberated in that space. It's not. It's just it doesn't look like what we're having right now, which is very interesting to me. And I also work in a university, and there it always looks like this. So there's something going on for me where there's always a disconnect, where I work with these undocumented women who are very powerful, absolutely no fear getting in front of politicians and after recording, videotaping, asking all sorts of different questions, and then be in the classroom and have these other discussions that sometimes seem a little unconnected to these things. So for whatever that's worth, that's what I'm seeing out there.
Andy, do you have a question?
Yeah, I was curious of just tactically, how do we, if we're in a discussion about bodily autonomy or specifically reproductive rights, how do we make an argument that's not a liberal argument? How do you delineate a radical argument for bodily autonomy, reproductive rights, compared to the standard liberal argument?
Do you guys want to take a crack at that, or maybe take a few more questions and
figure
out what the hell you're going to say that?
Yeah.
All right. So I think we had John, and is anybody craning?
Okay. All right,
so John.
I want to go back to where Wilson started about sort of the stranglehold that the liberal feminists have had on this issue, the fault of the left, onto that. And I think some of it has to do with my recollection, some of the unfolding of the women's liberation movement that erupted at the end of the 1960s and then fairly rapidly transitioned into a feminist movement. I mean, I think it's really important to remember that as part of SDS and perhaps as part of a reaction to SDS, there was a kind of a radical women's movement that emerged, okay? But that very quickly went away. And one of the reasons why it went away, it seems to me, is with Roe v. Wade, which is a classic liberal defense of women's rights. Remember, the basis of that position is the right to privacy, not the right to bodily autonomy or any of those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, people became content, okay, to live in that universe, to allow that to be the kind of the reference point. And similarly, when it came to the question of sexual freedom or sexual liberation, okay, what we got instead was sexual liberalization, which basically meant that the same way that those Nazis don't like what Anglin does in the Daily Stormer, okay, a lot of regular, ordinary men in this society who may or may not have retrograde attitudes on a lot of things, and a lot of women for that matter too, take deep exception to the kind of parade of liberalization of sexuality, which has resulted in pornography being the main kind of the staple of the internet. I mean, that's part, in a sense, We didn't get sexual liberation. We didn't get women's liberation. What we got was liberalism and feminism. And part of going back to kind of being careful about our words, I want to urge us to think about the possibility that feminism is not an especially good word for us to be using when we talk about our politics. It may be a good word for them to use when they talk about their politics, but that we instead have to embrace, as Wilson was arguing, the kind of the politics of women's liberation instead. Which is, and one last thing, and I think today there's been a little bit too much of a preoccupation with the question of the class or the working class, because I think in many ways we have to define our political project as a project of human emancipation and not simply, okay, something has to do with the workers doing something to make their lives better or to make the world better. It has to be fundamentally a matter of human emancipation, which is unimaginable without women's liberation.
Okay, so how much more time do we have on this panel, John? About 10 more minutes?
I gave up my moderator.
All right. Well, I guess that's on me.
Yeah, 5 minutes.
Okay.
Well,
I'm going to take this opportunity very quickly. Jacob was nice enough to lend us his MacBook. We're kind of doing this. We're doing this wonderful live stream to what, like 5 different states or something, kind of on the fly. Make it 4. So if anybody has a MacBook, any kind of with Google Hangout, it would be. Your duty to the movement will be done for the day.
Mac Air.
Okay, you want to get it going? Make sure it has Google Hangout because Jacob's going to leave at 3:30. Maybe we can do one or two more questions, and then if you guys want to just kind of want to wrap.
Yeah.
So let's see. We've got some hands up from Rob. Sorry, what's your name?
Bob.
All right.
Thanks. Couple things. On just the last point that John made about the term feminism, I think we have to be really careful about drawing out kind of lines as to what things are acceptable without really looking at what radical and revolutionary women themselves are saying, both white women and women of color. I've done a lot of readings where, whether it's Nicaragua or Puerto Rico or black women here or all over the world have embraced the term feminism in a very revolutionary way. So I don't think we should get hung up on defining what we think is liberal versus radical. But more fundamentally about the kind of way we're approaching all these questions, I just want to support what Naomi said earlier about looking around this room, who's here and who's not here, and thinking, and this is not a guilt trip. This is about thinking critically about how we can move forward more strategically in building struggles for liberation, for human liberation, as several people have said. And that if we continue to go to the same circles that we've gone to for years, and this is not to negate the good work that Insurgent Notes is doing and the importance of having this meeting, but if you just limit it to that, you're going to get the same results and the same composition of the room. And then you also have to look at how you run the meetings, who's facilitating, how they facilitate, how much women get interrupted versus how often men get interrupted. And there's a whole set of writings that people really need to look at about the ways men exert male supremacy even in progressive spaces and meetings. So I just think, and I'd be interested in the two speakers reflecting on how this can, the next iteration of what's happening today and many other meetings like it can be built in a more inclusive and liberatory way for women, people of color, trans people, all the folks that need to be at the table. And it's not just, they really should be there for the action component, of course, but they also should be there for the theoretical component because we all have a contribution to make. It's not just white men who are intellectuals and college educated who have the monopoly on telling us what the best theory is.
That might be a nice question to take us out on. Do you guys each want to respond?
Sorry, what?
No, it's good.
I'm certainly not ready to cede the notion of feminism to liberals. I think that there's a long and important legacy of black, radical, poor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, queer feminists, which I explicitly want to align myself with, and I think that all of us should. And yeah, men need to think more about gender and read more about their privilege and the way that they take up space and time. What was the other question? The like, how could we think of a radical politics around reproductive rights? I think, I don't know, to me it seems sort of fairly obvious that it's a, first of all, that it's like a non-reformist reform and that it should be at the forefront of our demands, like universal health care of all kinds, but also that a radical intervention can be a real kind of rejection of the respectability politics that often colors discourses around, and you know, the actual struggle around something like abortion access, right, of really patently refusing the rhetoric that you know, it's only okay in the case of rape or incest, or you know, if it's a impoverished child and they're 6 weeks pregnant, but saying like, this is a woman's fucking right to choose, period.
I just want to like just expand on that a little bit more. I think like part of what's happened since the 70s, right, I mean, like in the 70s you had like women of color feminists who were just like, yeah, abortion of course is really important and reproductive rights, but like what we face too is like, how do we reproduce ourselves in our daily existence, right? And I think part of, since the 70s, right, like the discourse of rights or like access to bodily autonomy, right, like it has been within the purview of like legal rights that the state has been able to grant to some degree, right? And now we're facing a moment of that rolling back and kind of like, you know, now like putting ourselves in the same fight maybe as before, like, you know, kind of fighting the state on these issues, right? But at the same time, I think like we have to start connecting more of these issues, struggles, right? So it's not, for me, it's like not, like reproductive rights is like so tied to like social reproduction. Like, how can we talk about abortion is like, if we don't talk about like, how is it that we produce ourselves like every day, like all the things that go into that, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the limits of liberal feminism sometimes, right? Because it's like, even though now who knows what the state can or cannot grant, right? So maybe we are in this moment where it's a non-reformist reform, but it has to be tied to these other parts of like how we exist, right? And how we exist as like people that don't get paid a lot, but now the working hour is longer, right? So now the state is like, oh, I'm gonna give you universal childcare, right? You go to the Bronx, universal childcare is like plastered all over, right? And it's like, yeah, that's great. Now you can work longer, right? Like, we got you. We got your children. Why don't you go work your 15-hour jobs?